Hello and welcome to this first episode of A Life in the Landscape, which is a podcast by me, Peter Cox. And because listening to me yammer on for some length of time about a subject is not all that interesting, I have invited my friend Roger Overall to join me. Are you there, Roger?
I am. That's right, listener. I am here to save you. I am your superhero. I am here to protect you from
all
the
right,
monotony.
That's enough of that.
All right, then. Fair enough. We have previous in this regard, Peter and I. We've started recording our first podcast 2010.
Is it really?
Yeah, that came
nearly
out.
10 years.
That came out wrong because basically it sounds as if the podcast is still recording, which actually is not far off the truth, because the first time Peter and I recorded an episode of a podcast, it took what, 8 hours? Something ludicrous.
It was at least that. Yes, I do remember there was we took an awful lot of time to be very professional about it, and then we realized immediately afterwards that was completely a waste of time.
Well, you know, a podcast recording has gone on too long when it has a lunch break and a dinner break. Anyway, so here we are, and the idea is that Peter and I chat about Peter's life, because let's be honest, Peter does all kinds of things that you and I can only dream of. We live vicariously through Peter. Hands up if you've been to the Antarctic.
I'm raising my hand.
See, nobody else is. Nobody else is. Sure, well, I'm not. So that's the idea. Peter does all these amazing things, all these incredible things, and he just does things that are interesting. And we want to give you an opportunity to hear about those things and experience those things through the medium of audio. And as Peter has said, rather than have Peter talk about these things, we're going to have a conversation and a chat. And this week's episode, don't get your hopes up. This episode is going to be about Iceland. Because, Peter, you're just back from Iceland, aren't you?
I am indeed just back from Iceland, yes. I had a winter trip there that I ran with my good friend Daniel Bergman, who is an Icelandic nature photographer that I've actually known for 11 years now. Scary. And, in fact, it was with Daniel that I had my first ever workshop experience, which, sorry, that sounds a bit like something else. But anyway, in 2006, 1 year after I decided that I was going to try to make this professional photography malarkey work, I saw on the Luminous Landscape a report that Michael Reichman had done about a trip he did to Iceland with Daniel. And I thought, wow, that looks like an amazing place. I'd really like to go there. And, you know, if I'm going to be a professional photographer, I should go and look at this interesting place. And it was basically a way of rationalizing the amount of money that I would have to spend to go there and do it. But I spent the money and I went there, and it was the first and only time that I ever actually went on a workshop. So you could say that Daniel completely turned me off workshops, being a participant.
But yeah, no, you thought, no, this is nonsense. I can do much better than this. I can do this better. And so a career was born.
There you go. Yeah, it was fantastic. And so that was 2006. And then a couple of years later, I started doing workshops myself. And I've been working with Daniel ever since. So yeah, this year we had our winter trip. We've done a few of these. And the thing about Iceland is that it's an amazing landscape. It's, you know, it's really otherworldly. In places, it's not very different from Ireland. On the south coast, there are some areas that could be Irish. But pretty much everywhere else, it's just incredibly varied, from black sand volcanic landscapes to red geothermal pools and snow fields and all sorts of incredible coastal features. And if you go in the summer, it's relatively warm. Warm is a very relative term there, but it's not freezing. And then when you go in the summertime, you have great light all evening. If you have good weather, you can shoot all night long and you get this kind of great sunset, sunrisey light for hours on end. And then in the winter, you have snowy landscapes and you have the potential to shoot the aurora, which is always there at nighttime, but it's in the summertime, it's too dark, too bright to see it. So winter is one of my favorite times to go. But unfortunately, winter can have some downsides in that the weather cannot always be, shall we say, stellar. So one of the things about workshops is I usually run them for 10 days. And the thing about these 10 days is that it gives you time to experience the place. It gives you time to visit a lot of locations, but it also gives you a little bit of insurance against the weather. And unfortunately, on this particular occasion, it didn't really give much. we had sort of, you know, 9 days of nearly constant rain and gray skies, and to boot, no auroral activity. So, you know, you can imagine that that can be a little bit challenging.
How do you cope with that then? So there you are, you've got a group of people, they're in this amazing landscape. Surely this amazing landscape is amazing, whether or not the sun is shining, whether or not it's tipping down with rain. It's still an amazing landscape. But how do you deal with that then from that perspective? I mean, you as a photographer, you're standing in a landscape, you're looking out over it and you're going, well, I'm not getting the golden sunlight and I'm not getting the aurora borealis, but I am here and I'm a professional. I am Peter Cox, the professional photographer. What is your mindset? How do you deal with that situation when you're on location and it's harder work than normal? It isn't being gifted to you. It isn't being presented to you on a platter. What do you do?
So actually, one of my favorite times to photograph in Ireland is in the winter. And it's because you get dramatic light. Now, obviously, when you have sort of overcast conditions and you don't have stormy clouds, we've got broken light and things like that, it's a bit harder. But you do get a great sense of character in the landscape. And, you know, golden sunrises and sunsets are beautiful and they're fantastic fun to photograph. But they are kind of a dime a dozen, and they're kind of easy. Like when you're there and you have that light, I hate the saying that, you know, it's hard to take a bad photograph because, well, there's plenty of evidence to the contrary. You still need to know what you're doing, but it's very, very easy to get something once you know a little bit about what you're doing. It's not much of a challenge. When the light is more difficult, when it's flatter, when it's gray, you have to work that bit harder. And that's certainly what we did with the participants that we had on this trip, who all really enjoyed the trip. You know, a big part of these things is the fun of being out with other photographers and listening to me and Daniel Yamaron and then learning from each other. But also, and this is something that's sometimes neglected on workshops, is the learning aspect of actually teaching people how to make better photographs. And I think there's actually no time better for that, than when the light is challenging. Because you get to get people outside of their comfort zone and get them thinking in ways that they're not used to thinking.
So just imagine for a second that you and I are out taking photos. Actually, immediately reminds me, even just sketching that idea that you and I would be out taking photographs. Because that one of the first times that we went out to take a picture, I just tell you, listener, just between you and I, Peter doesn't need to know this. So there, Peter and I are out on these rocks, and we're in pretty much exactly the same spot. There's not a foot between us and our tripods. And I swear to God, my photograph compared to Peter's, it was like Peter was photographing on a different planet, on a different universe. It was just magnificent. And same time, same location, same spot. So you can bring to bear quite clearly a photographic ability to a situation. And then people like me, who have absolutely no ability as a landscape photographer, can just produce a complete pile of, you know, you obviously do bring a lot to a scene. Let's just imagine that you and I are standing there in Iceland. It's wet, it's rainy, it's cold. It's what are you telling somebody like me?
So it's all about seeing what's in front of you and what's been given to you and letting go of your expectations and often your disappointment. You know, if you go to a place like Iceland, you know, you're looking to get a certain kind of photograph. You've seen them on, you know, all over the internet. So the first thing you have to do is you have to let that go and say, okay, I'm not getting that today. You know, I might get it tomorrow or I might get it next month or next year, but I'm not getting it today. So, but I'm here. So what do I do? So you look at what's in front of you. And if you've got, and also that, you know, Daniel's job and my job is to bring you to places that are going to photograph the best in the light that we have. So if it's a grand landscape type of photograph and it's low clouds and there's not very good visibility, then there's not really much point in that. So we would take you someplace else. For example, we might take you to a waterfall, of which Iceland has probably all of the waterfalls in the world. It's really quite remarkable. Around every corner, it seems, there's another waterfall. In fact, we have an expression, which is it's a Jaffa, which is just another waterfall. But waterfalls are great for overcast conditions, poor visibility, because those kinds of conditions bring out texture in the details of the rocks, of the water, of the vegetation, and it also brings out the colors. So if you have a bright sunny day, it will tend to blast out those details so you don't really see them as well, whereas overcast, soft light brings out all that texture. And it's also fantastic for details, for what we would call the intimate landscape, which is a photograph that has no horizon, that just looks at the textures or patterns in a subject. So you might find and isolate some details in the waterfall itself, maybe in the rocks around it. You might even find something really interesting that's on the ground at your feet that has no water in it, but makes a very good photograph. And so it's not a photograph of the waterfall, but it's a photograph of the environment that it's in.
So clearly you're teaching people to use their, use their eyes. I mean, obviously they're using their eyes, otherwise they'd be tripping over themselves constantly, but you're teaching them to look at the landscape in a very different way. Then it's almost a blessing in disguise, because take away the gorgeous sunlight and you are suddenly left with just the landscape. It is the structures around you. It is the colors. And it's almost like the hand of God coming across with his big, beautiful paintbrush of a sunset or a sunrise. You're not getting that help. So it's you in the landscape rather than, I suppose, that picturesque, I expect gorgeous sunlight, that kind of golden light, which almost makes it too easy. So it sounds like then you're saying, well, look at it as a blessing, because now you actually have to engage with yourself and the landscape rather than falling into the trap of, hey, great, bit of sun, the sun is setting, it looks fantastic anyway. All I need to do is press the button in any direction. I'll point the camera in any direction and it will look fantastic because of the light. Now I actually have to engage with the landscape myself through my eyes and use my interpretation.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. My friend Daniel has this thing that he says, which is that he prefers a photograph to be more of a question than an answer. And it's a very good way of looking at things. So the grand landscape with the great golden light across the landscape, fantastic clouds, perfectly composed, is it's an answer. It's not posing any question whatsoever. You look at it and then you go, wow, that's amazing, and then you flip to the next thing. It doesn't have a lot of staying power, and they are kind of a dime a dozen. Whereas the photograph that is more thoughtful, which is often taken in more subdued light, poses more of a question and encourages you to try to take it in, try to understand it, and really appreciate the details within it. So that's not to say, of course, that the grand landscape with the great light has no value. Of course, it has value, but I think the better photographs are often the ones that are taken in the subdued light. Certainly some of my favorite photographs, for example, the famous black sand beach in Iceland that has the chunks of ice washing up on it, which is an amazing sight to see. And it's often photographed at sunrise, where you have these incredible sunrises, and picking up all the color, the ice picks up all the colors of the clouds. But my favorite photographs that I've taken from there, and I've been there on dozens of occasions, are ones that were taken on dull days, where you just have really great textures and details and you're not distracted by the colors and you can take in these subtleties.
I can see how that works, just so that you listening have some concept of my background. I am a photographer and I used to be solely a professional photographer, but not in the landscape space. I used to be a documentary photographer. And one of the things I would do is I used to photograph weddings from a documentary point of view. And people come up to me on a sunny day, which, we do have in Ireland, and people be going, oh, it's fantastic, isn't it? This sunlight is out and it's the sun is here and it's shining and there's blue skies. This makes your job easier. And actually, it didn't necessarily make the job easier, because it can also create very harsh shadows on people's faces and very, very different tones in terms of light and dark that, let's face it, digital cameras struggle with, or certainly they did back in the day. They just couldn't carry shadows and light areas at all. So it created some difficulties. And I often said, well, do you know what? Sometimes from my point of view, an overcast sky is better, because it's like photographing inside a massive softbox. Mm-hmm. Everything's evenly lit. And then you're concentrating far more on the story of what's going on, because there isn't the dramatic lighting to work with. There isn't the dramatic beam of light coming in through a church window that the bride may or may not step into or may not face into and smile or what have you. So you've lost the drama of the lighting, but therefore you're concentrating far more on what is happening, what is the story, what is going on, how are elements in the frame, in this case people, forming themselves, shaping themselves, relating to each other, and what kind of stories come out of that. So I can see that, you know, yes, you could have a fantastically dramatic photograph with lovely light, but would it tell the same story as one that you actually had to really think about and really concentrate on what was happening? And I can see the same working in the landscape as well.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, so that's one of the valuable lessons that can be learned. And then the other one, which I sort of touched on earlier, is the idea of letting go of your expectations. And, you know, I've had plenty of experience of that in my own photography, where I've gone to a spot and I've had a very specific idea of what it was that I wanted to get from it. And, you know, sometimes if it's local, you can certainly hold out for that sort of thing, because if you can go to the place again and again, you'll usually get it eventually. It might take a while, but you'll get it. But you also, if you only go and look, and then when it's not exactly what you are thinking about in your head, and you then turn around and walk away, you leave a hell of a lot of stuff on the table. And I've, you know, I have photographs that I've taken where I had that idea in my head, and even, you know, sort of relatively recently, where I should really know better. And I've made the photographs, and then they sat unused on the hard drive for sometimes years before I go back through and see it and go, oh, with fresh eyes and no preconceptions, I just see it come along on the little film strip and say, oh my God, that looks interesting. Let's have a look at that. And then I look at it and I see it and I say, okay, there's actually a lot of potential in this, and this has a lot of value. But because it wasn't what I was looking for at the time, I didn't see it then. And I do find sometimes on workshops that you catch people deleting photographs in the camera. And I always, always discourage that. Now, sometimes it's because, you know, they've taken a picture of their foot or you know, something really out of, with a clear technical flaw that's very serious, that's just a bad image. And that's fine to delete those, although I still advise people not to do that. But sometimes it's because they just think what they're taking is bad. And it's really important you don't ever delete in the camera, because you might, even if it's something that you think is really terrible, like it's a picture of your, out of focus picture of your foot, you might be thinking you're deleting that, but you might delete something else by accident. And, you know, storage is so cheap these days, there's no reason to ever just, you know, not ever delete in camera. When you get back to the computer, then the temptation is also to go through and just tag the ones that are not what you want and delete them. And a lot of people do that. And again, I would say don't. I delete nothing, except for the very, very obvious ones, which I will just do on the computer after the fact. But if it's just something that's, it's a photograph that I don't think is fantastic, I'll leave it. And of course, 99% of them, you never look at again. But there is that 1% that when you come back to, you go, hang on, I can see how this could work. Again, storage being as cheap as it is, there's no reason to not do that.
Do you, when you're on your workshops, do you have like evening gatherings where the participants are discussing the photographs they've taken? I mean, talk us through, actually, let's do that. Talk us through an average workshop day if somebody's out with you on one of your trips.
So basically we'll get up. It depends where we are and what time of the year. You know, in Ireland in the summertime or in Iceland in the summertime, it can be pretty full on because sunrise and sunset are so early and late respectively. But in general, you know, there might be a sunrise shoot before breakfast if it's summer somewhere and it's a really early sunrise. So we'll get up. People have the option to come with us or not. We always have a rule that says if you're not down when we say, then we'll assume that you've rolled over and decided to sleep it on, and so we'll leave without you. And most of the time, that's fine when people understand that. So anyway, we go on then, and we'll do our sunrise shoot. We come back from that, have some breakfast, and then we go out again usually, and then we're out basically all day. So we shoot, after breakfast, have lunch, shoot after lunch, have dinner, and then we might even go out and do a sunset shoot. It can be difficult when you're in an area of high latitude where things are like, you can't do sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset. It just, everybody gets worn out. And but we take advantage of the light that we get. So if it's really great light and it's not going to last, then we obviously push hard for it. There is this desire to cover as much ground as possible, get people to as many locations as possible. And in Ireland and in Iceland as well, very often you have a good balance because you have a certain number of days where you have good weather and you go out and you push hard and you take advantage of them. And then there are other days where the weather's not so good. And you might have a down day where, you know, we maybe go out once or twice and otherwise kind of relax and take it easy. And those are the days that we take advantage of that time and we work and do an image review is usually what I'll do. We'll have the participants pick a number of photographs, you know, 3, 4, 5, depending, and then provide them to us. And then on a projector or on a large screen, we show them and then talk about them and sort of give feedback. And it's a good thing to do relatively early in the workshop. Like we tried to do it, you know, usually before the midway point. Of course, we're always checking in with people beforehand in the field, and we have an idea of how people are doing and where they need help. But it's very helpful to sit down on a screen and everybody look at all the photographs that have been submitted. And so they're not only are they getting the benefit of the feedback on their own images, and of course, we ask people to provide, you know, images usually that they have questions about, which are usually going to be or should be the ones that are they are maybe least proud of, that they think they need the most help with. And so they get the feedback on their images, but then they also get to see how other people are photographing and they get ideas and inspiration from that. And then, of course, they get the benefit of the feedback on those people's photographs as well. So that's very valuable. And we'll do that, you know, once, maybe twice on a trip where we have a real sit-down session. But then there's always the informal, you know, sitting down around a cup of, you know, cups of coffee and at lunch or whatever, and just talking photography and giving general advice.
So let's talk about how you find the photographs then. When you're out and about and when people are with you and you are looking for photographs, you a hunter? I mean, you somebody who's constantly in motion, constantly driving, constantly looking. You see something, you pull over, everybody piles out, you take your photographs, everybody piles back in, and you're off again to the next location? Or are you more of a more sedate pace, if you like, that you've got a location in mind and you know that if you get there at a certain time the light will be good, or that it will suit a certain purpose in terms of photography teaching and instruction that you have in mind? Where do you sit on that scale? If we say one is the greyhound speed experience and the other is maybe I'm just trying to think now. This is where the analogy falls down. What's a really lazy dog? An old dog, old sheepdog experience. You know, 20-year-old sheepdog can barely be bothered to get out of their basket kind of experience. On that spectrum, where can people expect to be during one of your workshops?
So I'm more of a gatherer as far as that sort of thing goes. So I, yes. And in fact, this is interesting because on the Iceland trip just finished, there was actually some discussion about this. There was a, you know, one individual in particular was sort of, you know, in fact, raised this issue and sort of said, well, you know, there are some people that are, you know, they, if the light's not happening here, it's happening somewhere else. And famously, Michael Reichman of the Luminous Landscape, you know, was of that mentality. He didn't want to stay in one spot. If he wasn't getting it now, he wanted to go and get it somewhere else. And that's a very valid way of doing it. That's why, you know, some people just really are in that mode and they want to be moving. Whereas I would be more, you know, I have an idea for a location in mind and I want to get there. And what I do, and when I'm on my own photography, what I will do is I will go to a spot, you know, plan where I'm going to be for sunrise or sunset or whatever it's going to be, get there, spend the time and find a really good foreground that'll work with the background. And that can take a long time. You know, it's very easy to just lift the camera up, put the horizon down low and capture a dramatic mountain range with an interesting sky. It's harder to get a really good foreground that works in concert with the background. And sometimes you stumble across it, but other times, you know, you can spend hours walking around a location looking for a particular, you know, mixing of shapes of rocks and little outcrops going into the sea and, you know, maybe some nice flower somewhere. You're just looking for something that will work visually well with the background. So that's what I like to do. I'd like to go and find these things. And so on the workshops, what we will do is we go to the spot and we get out and we, you know, give people kind of a briefing on the area and what's, you know, particular places to maybe look for, particularly good spots, and send them off and then kind of walk around and check on how they're all doing. And then we'll stay there until the time is done. And obviously, if we get there and it's just not working because it relies on visibility and we don't have the visibility, then, you know, we'll do, if there's an option to go somewhere else that might be better, we'll do that. But the way that I approach things in my personal photography is I will get there, find the spot that I'm going to use, and it might take me a while to get to do that, so I arrive early. And then when I found it, I stay there. You know, I just keep the camera pointed in that same position with the same composition, and I'm just watching the scene evolve and watching the light change. And I might tweak the composition a little bit here and there to make it suit. Like, for example, if there's a particularly nice cloud formation, I might try to factor that in or not. But I just see what happens. I settle on the composition and then I take occasional photographs as interesting things are happening. And then afterwards, I look, sit back on the, or sit down and look at the computer and pick, you know, just run through them and pick the ones that jump out at me as being the standouts.
It always strikes me as the cue syndrome, that you're in a location and you think, well, it's not happening here, the light isn't here, it must be somewhere else, i.e. I shall join another queue. And inevitably, off you go to join the other queue. And the queue you were in suddenly starts moving, i.e. in the landscape terms, oh my goodness, suddenly it happens. But you're half a mile down the road because you're off again. It strikes me, I'd be fearful of that. I'd be one of these people saying, no, I want to stay here because if we move, guaranteed, something will happen here and we'll just have a succession of going to locations where we're just one step ahead of all the good stuff and there's like this trail of good stuff behind us that we've missed, and there'll be the one photographer who's coming up the rear going, oh, that place you've just gone for, oh, it's fantastic. That would be my fear.
Well, yeah, and that can certainly happen, and I've had that happen to me in the past. But then I've also had, you know, the opposite happened, where, you know, I sat in a location for 2 hours and got nothing. Whereas if I had just gone down the road 3 miles, you know, it might have been completely different. So you just never know. And I think the hit rate is probably about the same, depending on whichever approach you take. It's just, for me, you know, because I need to spend time in a place, I need to sort of settle into it. Then that style suits me better. Now, if it's a location that I know, if I know the place very, very well, then I might say, okay, well, I'll go to this spot here that I've been to a dozen times. And if I get the photograph and I say, oh, okay, this is the shot that I want from here, and actually I've got an hour of light left, I'm just going to scoot over to this spot half a mile away. I might do that, but rarely enough.
So on the Iceland trip that's just been, what for you? I mean, do you have an image or a location that actually you really enjoyed, regardless of the fact that the weather wasn't, you know, I suppose, hospitable? Is there a location? I mean, you mentioned the Black Beach or it's called the Black Beach, isn't it? Any other locations from this particular trip where you go, actually, that worked really well?
There were a couple, yeah. There were, I suppose, there was one on fairly early in the trip. We were in the Snæfellsnes Peninsula, which is this peninsula that's north of Reykjavik, and it's you know, got a fairly high, very high concentration of iconic sites. And there's a town there called Arnastapi, which has a sort of a basalt sea arch there's a lot of also basalt columns like you'd find at the Giant's Causeway quite nearby. And in fact, the sea arch itself is made of the same kind of rock. And you don't see it until you get right to it. And that day was absolutely weather-wise completely miserable. It was low cloud base. You couldn't see the mountains at all. It was raining, this really heavy, misty rain that if you're not properly equipped for it, which of course I would be, and we always make sure the workshop participants bring good outdoor clothing, but you get soaked through if you weren't wearing good gear. And we stopped, parked the bus, you know, in the car park there, and then you've got to walk maybe 250 meters to get to the cliff edge where you're looking down on this sea arch, and you don't see it until you're right on top of it. And so, you know, everybody got out, we walked down to the thing, and people were going, oh, God, well, it's a bloody waste of time, you know, we should just be drinking coffee today. But we got to the Sea Arch, and as soon as you got there, you could see this amazing sight where you have these, you know, big waves, because there was a wind blowing as well. So there were big storm waves crashing against the arch and against the nearby cliffs. And all the detail and the texture and the color in the water, the really subtle hues in the water were there. And the arch itself, all the detail and texture in the rock was there. So as soon as you got to that cliff edge, it was like, holy crap, look at this. And, you know, the people that hadn't brought cameras were like, oh, shit, I should have brought my camera. Maybe went back to the bus to get it. That was great from a, and even myself, you know, I mean, I've been to this location many times. I photographed it many times. And often when I've been to a spot many times, you know, I won't bring my camera out so I can spend time, you know, with the participants and make sure they're getting what they need. And on this occasion, I was like, wow, I wish I brought my camera, because I knew it would be better than people were thinking, but it was actually even better than I thought it was going to be. So that was a good one. And then there was also certainly, I think the highlight for most people on the trip was the ice cave. So one of the great things about winter trips in Iceland is you get to visit an ice cave. Well, we can't obviously promise it because conditions can prevent it. But in the wintertime, these caves form. So basically, they're formed by meltwater from under the glacier. And in the summertime, they're flooded, you know, they're being carved. And then in the wintertime, the glaciers are freezing more than they're melting. And so therefore, the water levels drop and there are these caves left behind. And they're really dramatic places. They're full of incredible colors and shapes and textures, and you can just point a lens, you know, even I one of my favorite things to do there is take a wide angle lens and just shoot up at the roof, and you're just shooting the details of the ice. So we tried to get, there were a few caves you can get to, and there was one in particular we wanted to visit, but it was completely flooded because not only was it raining, but it was also warmer than average, so there was melt and rain going on. So all the ice caves except for this one and another couple that were much harder to get to, that were like, you know, a couple of hours walk up the glacier, were inaccessible. But this one in particular, which involved, you know, a short walk across the moraine and then, you know, just a couple of hundred meters hiking across the glacier, which in itself is an experience for people because you got to put on crampons and you're hiking across this ice, which is just a load of fun. And even if it was just 200 meters, it was an experience. And then we get down this the slope and you've got this incredible landscape to photograph. And so we spent quite a lot of time in there. And even though it was kind of a rainy, misty day, it was again perfectly suited for this kind of photography because you have this soft light, which brings out all this color and detail.
So you clearly have an affinity for this kind of landscape, and your previous trip before Iceland was the Antarctic. And in fact, I have not known you to go somewhere that is dry and sunny. What is it with you, with the wet, the cold, the wind, the ice, the freezing, the sea? This is the antithesis of what most people would look for in there. You know, most people go, do you know what? We live in Ireland. We get enough rain. And when Ireland does a moist, wet day, it does it properly. and we have, you know, 50 shades of grey. Ha! Nothing. Well, 50, we've got thousands of shades of grey here in Ireland, and thousands of shades of green, but they're all muted. So most people go, I want some sun. I'm going to go to the driest, sunniest place, but not you. It needs to be wetter. It needs to be colder. What is it? What is it with you?
I'm just really tied to those landscapes, and there's just something about these places that call to me. So, I mean, you know, the places I go most often, obviously Ireland, Scotland, Iceland, Greenland, Svalbard, up in the high Arctic, the Antarctic, you know, even southern Patagonia and southern Chile and southern Argentina are places that I've been, and they're all cold and they're all windy and they can all be rainy or snowy. But they're so beautiful. And I suppose if from a personal standpoint, I don't really do well in heat. You know, I'm fair skinned, and if you shine a torch on me, my skin turns red. So, you know, for me, you can always put on more gear. Than somebody once said very wisely that there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing decisions. And it's very true. You know, there's some guys actually, we're here at home. I'm having my driveway done. You know, it's been this kind of potholed gravelly mess for the last 7 years, and we're finally getting around to getting a tarmac atomed. And so the guys came today to do the job, the first bit of the job, and it just was blowing a gale, and the temperature was down around, I mean, the wind chill was probably around -2 or -3, and it's hailing and it's raining, and these guys are out there working away, and but they're all, you know, comfortable because they're all dressed in you know, warm weatherproof gear with hats and gloves, and they're, you know, you just, okay, fair enough, yes, you'd like it if it was a nice sunny day, but it's if you've got the right gear, it makes any weather perfectly comfortable.
So where, just using my own language now, forlorn, windswept, remote, cold, cold places, where haven't you been yet? Where would you really like to go? Just you, if somebody could say to you, right, you know, I will drop you wherever you want to go. Where is it that you in your heart of hearts would like to go that you haven't been yet?
Oh, I'd say it's probably probably Kamchatka, I think. That's a place that's held my imagination for a while, and I would definitely, it's a place that I will certainly go at some stage by myself, and, you know, providing that that all works out, I may well run a trip there. But I think, you know, there are some places, there's some places you just like to visit and go to.
Why? Because obviously, the obvious question now is, did you play Risk when you were younger? Is that why you want Kamchatka? Because it was easy and you get points for it. A bitch to defend if you got a hole in you. Anyway, but no, why Kamchatka? Because that's the only reason I have ever even heard of this place, because it's part of a board game I used to play.
It's for those that don't know, it's the easternmost peninsula in Russia, and it extends down towards Japan. And it's part of the Ring of Fire, so it's full of volcanoes, and they're very picturesque volcanoes. They're the typical volcano. They're conical. They're often erupting, and so it's this incredibly dramatic landscape, and I have a thing for volcanoes. You know, I went to photograph Eyjafjallajökull in Iceland when it erupted in 2010.
This is where I get my traditional, that's easy for you to say.
There you go. So that appeals to me, and then the landscape, and it's the remoteness. I love remote places. You know, even in Ireland, my wife says that you never met a Bohareen that you didn't want to drive down. Sorry for those non-Irish people. Bohareen is what we say. It means small road in Irish, and so it's the little grass in the middle, single lane roads. You know, if one's going off down to the coast somewhere, I'll just drive down and just to explore where it goes. And so, you know, take that to an extreme. You've got, you know, Eastern Siberia where there are virtually no roads and you've got to get everywhere by helicopter. So that's the appeal.
That does sound pretty spectacular, I have to say. Even for me, that sounds really, really spectacular. But if you're hoping to go to Kamchatka with Peter, you're going to have to wait a while. But where can people go with you soon, Peter? You've got other workshops lined up, obviously. So what's coming up? Where can people go with you?
So the next trip that I have there's a trip to Scotland in May, which is full. And then I also have another trip to Scotland in September, October, which is to the Isle of Skye. And that's a 7-day trip that I'm running with my friend Steve Gosling. And then I also have my traditional Irish trip, which I run in the southwest, so counties Cork and Kerry here, and I'm running that in end of August, beginning of September this year, and again next year around the same time. And then I also, and this has just been announced, I am running a trip next year, so 2018, in July, August, to Svalbard with my friend Daniel, who I just ran the trip with in Iceland. So we've chartered a small 12-passenger ship that I've been on before, actually, in 2014. I ran two trips on it back-to-back. It's a wonderful ship. It's an ex-lighthouse tender, built in the 50s, full of character, great ice-strengthened hull, and can go places that a lot of other ships can't. And so we're going to be going up there to photograph the landscape, the wildlife, so polar bears, walrus, and glaciers, icebergs. It's an incredible place.
And it's wet and it's cold. No.
Well, that time of year actually is pretty good usually. It's high summer, so you get midnight sun. And yes, certainly it's chilly, but that's what the clothing is for.
Absolutely. That is what the clothing is for. So if you want to book yourself on one of these trips, where do people go? Where can the person listening to this podcast go to book themselves on one of these trips?
They can go to my workshop photography website, which is elevation.ie. And of course, you can also find links to that from my main website, which is petercox.ie.
Well, I think that's enough about your Iceland trip. That's enough about what's coming up. I think we'll call a halt to this episode. Now, what we should say is you've been listening to A Life in the Landscape, the Peter Cox podcast with Peter Cox, the man himself. Go to petercox.ie to find out more about Peter, to see more of his photography, to see his books, to see his prints. I can say this, Peter can't, to buy his prints. Go on, to buy his prints. And if you are ever in Ireland, if you are ever in a place called Killarney, go to Peter's gallery. Peter has a gallery in Killarney. So there's all these wonderful things. And you can follow Peter on Instagram and on Facebook and Twitter as well. I don't know. Yep. You'll have to tell me. Twitter as well. There you go. So, and you're Peter Cox on all of these. You're not some kind of weird...
Peter Cox photo on all of them, except Instagram, where I'm Peter Cox photography.
There you go. Anyway, Peter is not hard to find. Go and see, go and have a look. See his wonderful photography, book yourself on a trip, buy a print. Peter's far too modest, so, but I can say that, you know. And take your choice. He's got a family to feed, that'll make you feel good. Or I've got a puppy, and you know what happens if you don't buy a print. There we go. Thank you very much for listening. Join us again soon on A Life in the Landscape.